I think there are people that do come here that are part of the LGBT community and do come here to recreate and enjoy the park. And I think, at least I hope for the most part, most of them feel safe. Most of them feel supported by the people they interact with here in the park and in Yellowstone. And I know, at least, especially coming from more of a staff end, like from people that work in the park, I know everyone that I've worked with is very supportive of people in that community. And maintaining that support is what's something that's super important to me as far as being able to work here in the park and also being able to educate other people who work in Yellowstone and teach them that it's important that these communities are represented in Yellowstone.
What do you do when you come out as LGBTQ and love the outdoors? What do you do when you see the outdoor space ruled by older white cis men and desire a diverse community of outdoor lovers? Accept it, change it, create it. I am Justin Yoder, and this is LGBT Outdoors. What's up, everyone? I am Justin Yoder. I'm your host for LGBT Outdoors Podcast, and I am so excited to be here with you guys today. I have two great co-hosts that are joining me. My own husband and board member, Patrick Thompson.
What's up, everybody? You said that so, like, fancily. I'm your host, Justin Yoder. That was neat. Sorry, continue.
Thanks. I try to be neat, I guess. And JC Ranton, who is also a board member out in Colorado. You can say hi, Dad.
Hey, guys. How's it going? Wait, what?
You can say I'm neat, too, if you want.
Oh, wait, what do you mean by neat?
I don't know. Patrick said I was neat, that it was neat. So I was waiting for my compliment from you.
Some great listening skills there.
You're just fine. I'm kidding. You're fine. Yes, this is JC. They took me on for comedic relief.
If nothing else, that works. No, you had some benefit too. I mean, besides just comedic relief, I mean, you help out here and there.
I have some. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm super excited to be here. Our inaugural podcast. Super exciting.
JC, you went snowboarding yesterday?
I did. Yeah, I went to Copper. It was a lot of fun.
How was it? Who'd you go with?
I went with my friends London and Greg. They had friends from Tennessee too that came, so just kind of showing them around. It was a good time.
And nice. The snowboarding?
Yes. Yeah.
How drastically different is that than skiing?
Well, firstly, one of the reasons why I pick snowboarding is there's only one thing to put on your feet. I'm quite a spaz. All right. I think in this podcast, I'm going to be compromising myself. You'll get to know me very well. I don't like having like two things in my hands and then like the two separate things on my feet. I feel like that's just way too many things to handle. And with a snowboard, it's just one thing.
So many gay jokes in there.
Too much. It's too much to handle. One thing to strap on. Oh my god!
And yes. We are already off the rails, ladies and gentlemen. I thought JC was going to be like, "Well, snowboarding is a lifestyle," but no.
Oh,
like, nah. Too many things in my hand.
It is. It is a lifestyle.
I wouldn't expect that with JC. Well, that's cool. Are you guys going to do a LGBT outdoors event in Colorado with snowboarding or skiing this year?
Eventually, yeah. We're just waiting for more of the mountains to open. A lot of them are only halfway open. Just waiting for more snow to come in.
And it sounds like you might get it this weekend.
I think so. Yeah, keep it coming. Keep it coming. Sweet.
All right. Hey, we got a great guest for our first episode today. I'm excited. Are you guys excited?
Very.
Yes.
We're going to see how this goes, but I'm really looking forward to it. So our guest today is Dylan Sanborn, and he is a wildlife technician in Yellowstone National Park. So we are going to dive in with him and learn a lot about him, Yellowstone, the wildlife up there, and just have a great conversation. So Dylan, welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be speaking with you all. And also just JC, I'm a little jealous that you're going out snowboarding there, especially back in Colorado, which is actually where I'm from, and Copper. Great spot to go to. So definitely, yeah, I also agree with you a little bit with snowboarding too. Like, I think it's a little better than skiing just because you have the one thing to worry about instead of like multiple things.
We're going to get hate mail.
maybe a little bit.
This battle, ski versus snowboarding, is goes on for ages. So
is that kind of like the, okay, so you're talking to two Texans here. I guess that's kind of like the whole Android iPhone battle then in the snow world.
Ooh. Yeah. Yes. And we've learned to coexist.
That's good. That's good. That makes me happy.
If phone users can learn to do it, then surely skiers and snowboarders can. Maybe.
I'm not
one
sure.
Day.
I'm not. Have phone users been able to coexist? I'm not sure yet. But Dylan, tell us a little bit about you, your background, how you ended up in Yellowstone. Yeah, dive right in.
Yeah, of course. Well, I guess moving on from knowing that I snowboard, but anyways, going off that, so I've been here in Yellowstone for the past 4 years, so since 2018. I work here as, wildlife technician. I mainly study wolves and birds, so kind of two different major things that we have here in the park. Something that I really enjoy, my job involves quite a bit of time outdoors. Usually I'm outside about 75% of the time, just either hiking or traveling places throughout the park to study the wildlife that we have here in Yellowstone, which is a pretty rewarding job for sure. But yeah, it gets me outside at least, which is pretty awesome.
That's very cool. How'd you decide to get into that? And what took you to Yellowstone?
So I decided to get into that basically kind of based off of my college experience. So I went to Colorado State University back in Fort Collins, which is where I got my degree in wildlife biology. I first started out as zoology with a pre-vet track and kind of moved into the wildlife field during college when I started getting a little bit more enamored by kind of our wild animals, the habitats that they live in, and kind of protecting those two things. And, you know, the fact of just being able to be outdoors and study them and kind of their natural ecosystems is just been something that's kind of always been something that's been very fascinating for me. And honestly, it was a surprise actually being able to get into the field because it's super competitive and I just kind of worked very hard but also lucked out with where I'm at. So with Yellowstone, it's actually where I first started working here right out of college. I graduated on a Saturday and the next Sunday, so the day right after that, I went right up here for a job that I got with the bird program where I was mostly studying avian species. Wow. And then that was just a seasonal gig and that kind of turned into this year-round position where I started studying birds and then also wolves on top of that.
Wow, that seems like a big jump.
Yeah, so, definitely. Like, when you say like studying the birds or studying the wolves, are you observing and kind of taking notes of behaviors, or do you have like a specific kind of goal or thing that you're trying to learn about?
Definitely. We have a lot of different things we're trying to learn from them. So it's mostly through visual observation. So first starting out with wolves, it involves where we're actually watching them for pretty much every day of the year, where we're observing what behaviors they're doing, what they're eating, where they're traveling to, how they interact with the landscape, prey items, and so on. So we kind of focus a lot on that and kind of looking at their just general ecology and just making different pretty much observations from that and then collecting data that we use to be able to kind of figure out a few different things. In birds, it's kind of similar where we're doing that as well, but we focus mainly on stuff during the summer since a lot of the birds we have here migrate out in the winter. Right. So in the summer, we mostly focus on like breeding status where we're looking if the birds are breeding or not, how many young they're having and how many of those fledge. So kind of, pretty much involves just many hours of hiking and looking through a scope for a long amount of time to kind of simplify it a little bit.
Very cool. Have you found anything that surprised you? Like they're not supposed to be doing that or something contrary to what you sort of already understood?
Like there's a lot of different things that we could observe from like our observations. Like one of the most fascinating things for me that I got to see was when we were observing one of the most well-known packs here in the park, which is the Junction Butte pack, which at the time was a pack of about 35 wolves, one of the largest ever recorded in Yellowstone, which is already just, you know, pretty crazy in itself. But the big thing that we saw was a cool kind of prey switch. So wolves usually here in Yellowstone mainly focus on eating elk, and bison usually is a secondary prey item. Due to how many wolves were in that pack, they actually switched that overall, like, kind of selection for prey, where they're actually eating more bison than elk, which has been not seen here in the park in quite a bit of time. And it was mainly due to this pack being so large, which was probably one of my favorite things to see out here.
Well, the wolves have it right, because bison is tasty.
Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely good. Elk's not too bad either, though.
How do you guys monitor, I guess, that change in the diet?
So the way that we do that is from visual observations, especially during the winter here, which is where we're kind of more intensely watching those packs because they travel a lot more throughout the landscape. But during this time of year where we're actually doing an intensive prey study is where we're actually watching specific packs like that, the Junction Butte pack, which I mentioned earlier, from sunup to sundown. So I'm spending about 12 hours a day watching that pack and looking at every single little thing they do. And every time they take a prey item, we make note of that, and from pretty much the end of each season, we could look at what they're selecting for the most. And in that season, we saw that they were selecting the most for bison, which was pretty cool, considering they're also almost predating upon twice as many bison than elk, which is usually pretty unheard of here in the park.
So, like, we've all seen, I say we all, we most of us have probably seen the National Geographic where a predator is hunting a prey item, as you say, and we watch that kill happen on TV. You've apparently have watched this then quite a few times in real life. What is that experience like?
It's actually relatively, like, pretty quick when you see it. So, or actually, even most of the time, even though we're observing them most of the time, we actually see very few kills. Because as far as, like, how they hunt, they use a thing called terrain traps, which is where they actually will try basically chase those animals into a gully or like a hole somewhere that's like a little lower elevation. So most of the time from where we're watching, we see them chasing into there and then don't actually see the takedown. But the times that we do, it's usually pretty quick, where usually, especially for larger packs, they'll be able to take down an elk or sometimes a smaller bison relatively quickly. It's pretty quick where they'll take in, then they'll feed upon that animal usually for anywhere between 1 to maybe 3 or 4 days.
That's pretty amazing. Does one bison actually feed a wolf pack of 35?
Actually, that's a great question, especially for a pack that big. It's relatively not actually a lot of meat for them, because on average, wolves, say, eat about 23 to 28 pounds of meat in a sitting. And say if we went on the low end of that, like say 20, just to make the math easy, and say 20 pounds per wolf times 35. So that would be pretty much 70. So then after that, if you're doing that where pretty much if you multiply that by each wolf and kind of looking at how much they're eating, that a bison's barely going to last them, because a bison's about like say 1,000 pounds of meat or so. So for a single wolf pack to be able to sustain themselves off that, especially with 35 wolves, is not going to be a lot.
Yeah, it that's sound a like lot it. Of meat.
Yeah. So even if we did like 20 to 30, that'd be like 60 pounds per wolf. And, you know, it's just where of say like, in so yeah, 20 times 30 would be 600. So that's where even an elk, a bull elk, is about 700 pounds. And that's, you know, meat and bone. So after that, you know, they could eat a whole elk in a day and be done with it.
Gee,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Hungry puppies.
How many puppies? So in that year, they actually had 18 pups. And then so that pack was actually quite a big amount of like pups for it. And this year they have about 15. So quite a few. But even then, all of those are, you know, hungry mouths to feed, and they eat quite a lot. So, yeah.
What's the expected kind of life term for a wolf?
So here in Yellowstone, the expected life expectancy for a wolf is about 4 to 6 years. So
interesting.
A little bit shorter than you'd think, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking longer.
I mean, that it's a rough life. Like what they've got to try really hard at everything they do. Yep. Imagine they get worn out pretty quick.
Our dogs it rough when they don't get their dinner on time.
Exactly. Yeah. No, they have it pretty rough. And even then, like, besides, like, you know, them having to hunt things that are pretty hard to get, they also have to deal with the cold winter out here. Like, I think it's been like in the negative, like 20 some days here. So like they deal with that. They deal with, you know, everything. And just it's a rough life for wolves. So it makes sense why it's 4 to 6 years. But even, you know, some domestic dogs, especially larger ones, usually have something similar to that or maybe slightly longer.
Nice. Yeah. What's the in all of your time outdoors and observing for both the birds and the wolves, have you had a moment where you're just like, wow, but like I am doing what I am called to do, like, and I've just witnessed something that is absolutely affirming to everything that has led up, you know, to this kind of point?
Yeah, no, that's an awesome question. I'd say one of my favorite memories doing this type of work was being able to travel to the most remote area of the park, which is known as the thoroughfare, which actually is the most remote area in the lower 48. It's about a 32-mile hike each way to get into it.
Ooh.
And being there, like being able to travel there for work and seeing this untouched area that was just immensely beautiful, but also being there to be able to study animals. And the great thing about that is we were studying peregrine falcons back there, and they were territories that haven't been observed in the past 4 years. And we got down there and all four of them were occupied, which was the first time we ever got that, which was amazing. And then also two of those had young, which was pretty special to see. And then also it being the area that we're in, which was just amazing. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a question.
Go for it.
I always think about, so actually I wanted to know if you didn't end up in this line of work, what would you have, I guess, like pursued?
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's a tough question because I don't know, like I love the job that I'm doing so much that it's hard to think of doing anything else. But I guess the closest thing I'd do besides like research would be actually maybe wildlife guiding, which is, again, still wildlife, but it's a very different side of the coin. It's where you're not so much studying animals, but you're bringing people out, especially like local people or, you know, people all throughout the world to see these animals. Like, you know, kind of what they have is like safari guides in Africa, but also they have guides like that here in Yellowstone where they take people out to see animals. But otherwise
that job
you should ask my partner Tyler. He actually does that as a job. He's a guide for wildlife, so it's really cool that we both do kind of wildlife related things but very opposite sides of the same coin.
That's really cool. How much does your work involve working with visitors that come to the park, or are you just like totally disengaged from that aspect of it?
I'd say actually interacting with visitors is a pretty like common part of my job, because part of what we focus on besides research and management is also education and interp. So where we focus heavily on, you know, talking to people and telling them about what we're studying and why it's important. And that's actually one of the most rewarding things about my job, is being able to tell people about these experiences that I've had and share them with them. Because again, like what's research and, you know, studying these animals without being able to talk to people about it and kind of open up this conversation about why we're doing these like, you know, crazy things of like hiking multiple miles to see these animals and so on, and why it might be important and how like the guest might be interested in like trying to learn more about it. So yeah, I would actually say surprisingly, like engaging with the public is actually a pretty big part of my job. And usually I'm almost engaging with guests or visitors almost every day.
Do you feel like the visitors often think about wolves as like, have a misconception of the wolves, I guess? Like reality versus what a lot of people think about wolves?
Like from Hollywood, for example?
Like the big bad wolf?
Yeah. Yeah, like the dramatized, like big bad wolf, everything.
Or the Gray.
Oh, the Gray. Oh, the Gray. That's a good movie to debunk.
That's some scary stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, that one's full of inaccuracies. But yeah, no, with, I think like any type of like animal, or especially like something that's more of a little bit of a contentious issue, especially pertaining to wolves. I feel like there's always a lot of like slight misconceptions here and there, and you know, most of them could prove false. Like, I feel like, for instance, like people have this, as we were talking about, like this dramatized like kind of version of wolves, like, you know, think of it in The Gray, where they're these ravenous creatures that are kind of scary, and they're actually not. Like, when you watch them most of the time, like, they're super far away. People also think that like they're scary to deal with, like, where, you know, like if you're in the backcountry, you have to watch out for wolves, they'll get you, which that's a huge misconception. Wolves actually most of the time are more scared of you than you are of them. They will run away, like they don't want anything to do with you, versus like here in the park, the biggest thing to actually worry about is grizzly bears, which we have plenty of and are definitely a lot more scary than wolves. So I think like the general fear of wolves is kind of one of the biggest misconceptions I see, at least out here. And definitely like wolves are nothing to fear, and they're amazing animals, especially for, you know, to observe, but also for people like, you know, come out and see here in the park.
That's pretty amazing. I'm still waiting to see some in the park. I think it was it last time we were up there, Patrick? We had just missed a kill.
Yeah.
Or like feeding, I think.
Yeah. And what was notable about it was that it was viewable. So it wasn't like, you know, deep off the trail. Like, it was within viewing distance from a road. And so somebody had actually, you know, filmed it. But yeah, it was a wolf and I think a bison, maybe. And so it was just interesting to see that, you know, kind of visually happening, kind of relatively out in the open. Because apparently that's rare. Maybe. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I would say that's pretty rare to see kills, because most of the time they're not usually always close. They're kind of, you know, hidden, all of that. But even seeing wolves in the park is sometimes can be generally hard to see them. Like, even when we're out studying them, there's certain packs that we never see, or we might see like, you know, every few months, versus there's ones that we see every day. So like seeing a kill is definitely pretty rare. And I think a lot of people, when they come out here, that's kind of like the thing they envision with seeing with wolves, which is really cool to see, but you know, just it doesn't happen super often. So the fact that you guys got to see that out there is pretty special and kind of awesome. And I assume you probably saw that either in like Hayden Valley or Lamar Valley or something like that.
I saw it on YouTube.
Oh, you saw it on YouTube. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you saw it on YouTube. Oh, I see.
Yeah. It happened like a couple days after we were there.
I think you're confusing the elk, the grizzly bear with the elk that drowned the elk versus with the wolves. What happened with the wolves was we just saw a bunch of people pulled over, and we stopped to, of course, ask what was going on. The wolves had just finished feeding and went back up into the woods, and they were hoping that they were going to come back down to eat more. But we waited for a while and never saw them. But the time before that we were there, which you'll probably know this video because this is really popular on YouTube, is the grizzly bear that chased the elk down into the lake and then climbed on its back and drowned it and ended up eating it. That happened the day after we were there.
I remember that carcass. It was the one on the north side of Hidden Valley and the Yellowstone River there.
Yeah, I think so. It was a really popular video that went around not long after that happened, showing it.
Yeah, no, that was a really cool kill. It was not too far from the road. It was across the river, and yeah, a lot of people got to see it. But yeah, if people see that video, it's just, you know, this huge boar grizzly just taking on this bull elk and drowning in the river. And then eventually, I think in that same video, it shows it just dragging it to shore. And it ended up feeding on that carcass for almost a week or so, and it was staying there, and sometimes the wolves would try to get on it as well too. And it was a pretty cool sighting for a lot of the people that were out here at the time.
Winnebago Industries is a leading U.S. manufacturer of outdoor lifestyle products. Their goal is to help their customer, from glamping enthusiasts to off-road explorers, embrace the outdoors through one of their recreational vehicles, powerboats, or pontoons. Winnebago Industries is proud to partner with leading industry and outdoor-oriented organizations such as us, LGBT Outdoors, who share in their desire to enable extraordinary mobile experiences for everyone. Together, we can all be great outdoors. Talking about bears, I would love for you to talk to us about, because you have black bears and grizzly bears there. A lot of times when we hear people talking about a bear attack, or, you know, what to do if a bear is charging or all this stuff, like it's different for the different kinds of bears, right? So depending on if it's a black bear or a black bear or a grizzly bear, it depends on what you should do. Can you shed some light on that and talk to us about that?
Yeah, definitely. So there is a difference between how you react to those situations just because of how the bears react to you. So grizzlies definitely are the scarier of the two cases because they're much larger, they're more aggressive, and they'd be more likely to possibly cause harm to a person. So with grizzlies, it's where the big thing with them is, you know, of course, having bear spray, maintaining your distance, and that's with, you know, any bear or, you know, large carnivore in the park. And then also, if they do approach you, not trying to make yourself big and loud, because that actually could agitate them. That's what you want to do with black bears. For grizzlies, usually the big thing that you want to do is you want to try to back away slowly while still kind of looking at where they're at. Try to get something in between you and them. So like if you're, say, like, you know, in a forest, like try to like have it where you can kind of slightly get behind like a log, but also make sure that they still could see you, because sometimes if you go completely out of view, they'll freak out and be like, okay, where is this thing? And they'll start searching for you. So you definitely don't want to do that. So maintain something between you, so there's a block, but still where they could kind of see you. And then if they do charge, the big thing is don't run. Do not run. That is the biggest thing, because they will continue to keep chasing after you in that case. And it's better to stand your ground. And as soon as they start getting closer, and it seems like it's going to be a situation where they might be going after you, is using bear spray. So where bear spray usually has about an 8 second charge of spray within it. So the big thing you want to do is usually spray it slightly for maybe a second or two to get a wall in front of you. So it's kind of creates this like misty type, like kind of stuff with it that has like capsaicin and, you know, stuff that's going to agitate the bear's, like, you know, nasal passageway and everything. And with that, it's where they will eventually hopefully stop and turn around because of the bear spray. And if they say don't do that, and they, you know, they're right on top of you or something, the big thing is to kind of make yourself like smaller into a ball. Like if you have like a backpack on, leaving that on, so like it could be, you know, used to protect your, you know, your backside if they start trying to go after you. And that's kind of a very rare scenario that doesn't happen here in the park, but, you know, it's something good to know if they do go after you. And then black bears, as far as issues with them, they're not as common here in Yellowstone as grizzly bear attacks, but still with them, the big thing is kind of doing the opposite of what I mentioned with grizzlies, and you want to make yourself loud with them and make yourself big, because they're a little more timid compared to grizzlies, because they're a lot smaller and they're also can maybe see you more of as a threat, versus grizzlies so big, they're, you know, they don't think you're any issue of any sort. So yeah, black bear would be, yeah, making yourself big, kind of yelling at them, trying to like get them to run off, and most of the time that usually works. And then using bear sprays if you have it as well, in kind of the same way that you would for a grizzly.
So I'm going to ask a very, very basic question, but I see a bear. How do I know if it's a grizzly or a black?
Oh, that's actually still a good question. I think there's some people that don't always know the difference, and especially because black bears could also have kind of more of a cinnamon colored appearance to them, like kind of like a grizzly. So like coloration sometimes is not the most reliable thing to use, because, you know, there's cinnamon black bears that could look very similar to it. And then I would say the biggest thing is looking for size. So a grizzly, they are very large. Like if you're like, oh wow, that's a huge bear, it's probably a grizzly. Grizzlies also have very broad faces. They have kind of more rounded ears and a large hump on their back, versus black bears don't usually have that large hump as much. Like they have it where they're a lot smaller, like their face is a little more narrow and kind of longer. So kind of looking for those differences. And then also if it seems like, you know, kind of small on the smaller end, it's probably a black bear.
Good to know. So talking about bears and wolves, if any of our listeners are new to the outdoors, we definitely don't want to be scaring you off with this information. But it's good to know about the wildlife in the area that you're going to, for sure. Going kind of from the wildlife aspect, you know, you being a gay man that's working in a national park, what's it like and what is like representation there like, and visibility with the LGBTQ community?
Yeah, so as far as being a gay man working here in Yellowstone National Park, I feel very comfortable with being open with who I am. Like, as far as like with who I work with and who I interact with, most people know I identify as a cisgendered gay man. Most of them actually know my partner very well as too. And like with me, like I feel like I've had a very supportive community here with the people that I work with, the people that I've interacted with as far as guests that are, especially ones that I've known for a while. And I've never really had a huge issue with that. And it's surprising because like here in Yellowstone, because it's so rural, some people might think it might not be as open, but actually since it's such a small community here, a lot of people all know each other and are very supportive of each other and kind of who they are. And I've had it where I've had amazing experiences being open with who I am and being open about my gay relationship with my boyfriend. And it's been pretty awesome, like having that and having, you know, a community that's very supportive of, you know, who I am and who I love and everything, which is great.
Yeah, that's amazing. Do you feel like there's a lot of visitors that come to Yellowstone that are part of the LGBTQ community?
Yeah,
I think hard to know.
I think it could be hard to know sometimes, but I think there are people that do come here that are part of the LGBT community and do come here to recreate and enjoy the park. And I think, at least I hope for the most part, most of them feel safe. Most of them feel supported by the people they interact with here in the park and in Yellowstone. And I know, at least especially coming from more of a staff end, like from people that work in the park, I know everyone that I've worked with is very supportive of people in that community. And maintaining that support is something that's super important to me as far as being able to work here in the park and also being able to educate other people who work in Yellowstone and teach them that it's important that these communities are represented in Yellowstone and that they're supported just as they would be with anyone else. And I think there's been a really good push for that here in Yellowstone. And especially as far as like even our staff, we have a super diverse staff. We have several people that are actually open and identify with the LGBT community, and none of them feel at least afraid or friend because of who they are, which I think is amazing. Yeah,
that's encouraging to hear. I mean, as part of what we do as LGBT Outdoors is helping to raise visibility with the community in the outdoors. So knowing that national parks get on board on that is definitely something that's encouraging to hear.
About how many people work either for or inside the park on like a given day?
So it depends a lot on the season, because during here in the winter, it's, you know, very slow and we have a pretty small staff. But going based off of like what we have here in the summer, which is when most people come out here, we usually have a few hundred to a few thousand people on staff between either people who work directly for the park or ones that work for like concessionaires that are working in the park and so on. So there's a pretty large staff out here. And I think mainly for the main park, like people who are more directly, you know, associated with it are like a few hundred.
And that's inside of like, how big is the footprint of the park?
So the overall size of the park is pretty large. So with Yellowstone, overall, like the size of it, it's about 3,471 square miles. So it's huge. Wow. Like Yellowstone is a very large park. To even just drive the inner loop of it, it takes about a full day. So Yellowstone's huge. And that's just the roadways. If you don't include like backcountry stuff, like there's even more of it. So.
Wow. That's wild. And so for such a large, area of land and a relatively large workforce, it's good to hear about the diversity of the people who keep everything, operating, but also continue to advance like the understanding of the wildlife and the scientific endeavors there as well. It's really cool.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. And that's where like I really applaud like what you guys are doing, because it's bringing, more visibility to people in the outdoors, because I feel like there's sometimes that issue of people not associating the gay community or LGBT community with the outdoors. And the fact that you guys are really pushing for that and showing that, the outdoors are meant for anyone and anyone can enjoy it. And the fact that, you know, actually the LGBT community makes a huge part of, you know, outdoor recreationists. And I think that's just really cool that you guys are showing that, you know, we're out there and we enjoy the outdoors and, you know, we're in very different capacities of like how we're enjoying it and what we're doing with it and how we, you know, enjoy and love like natural spaces that we're going to.
Definitely. One thing that we are really trying to do is, as like you mentioned, you know, like the LGBTQ community makes up more of the outdoors and outdoor recreation than what most people think. And so we actually have, it's called LOVES for short, but the LGBT Outdoors Visibility Survey. We're getting ready in January to start posting results from that, but it's a survey on our website that anybody listening can actually go and fill out. And it helps gives us information to be able to show what percentage of our community does get outdoors and how they feel about hiking on trails alone or in groups. And if they've ever faced discrimination or harassment on trails in the outdoors or in outdoor industry, as far as stores goes as well. So we're excited to be able to bring some of those statistics to light because there really isn't anything out there on it now. And everybody thinks, oh, you know, you're gay, so you can't go into the outdoors or it's too rugged for you or whatever the case might be. But in all reality, there is a large percentage of our community that does love the outdoors.
And so, there'll be a link to the Love Survey in the show notes.
Perfect. Perfect. JC, you have any other questions for Dylan?
Not questions. But I am excited. Cause Dylan, just so you know, part of what we're trying to do for 2023, you know, for
do I sense LGBT an announcement coming?
Oh yeah, a little preemptive you know, make sure we follow through on this.
Go for it. I know, now I we have to do so, it, right?
So lately, I mean, we've only been doing, for our chapters, we've only been doing like hikes, like locally. I know some of the events that we've held are at national parks, but starting in 2023, we're really gonna, we're gonna organize trips dedicated to exploring the park. So people are gonna have to take days off if they can, and it's gonna be either like a long weekend or almost a week if people can do it. Just to go at different national parks. And I know Yellowstone has been talked about too. So we might be headed your way eventually.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely let me know when y'all are out here because I'd love to, you know, show you around the park, show you some of the animals we get to see out here. And, you know, even if you're not in Yellowstone, also Grand Tetons is a pretty awesome park and my partner's down there as well. Yeah. So either of those spots, definitely reach out and let us know. And we'd love to kind of show you around the parks.
Oh, are you so only cool. Yeah, that'd be great. Do you only work exclusively in Yellowstone or do you have do you have times where you'd have to go at other national parks too?
So with me, I just work in Yellowstone, so that's the only park I really work in just because I work as a researcher there. But my partner, he actually works in both doing wildlife guiding tours, so he does tours where he's showing people both Tetons, Yellowstone, showing scenic areas, you know, wildlife, all that stuff. So he works a little bit more between the parks because he works for more of a private company versus me working directly for the park. I have it where I have to, you know, more of stay here.
Gotcha. Yeah. I, you know what? I actually have never looked on a map, the distance between the two. Is it drivable?
Yeah, no, it's
only
actually
like 30 miles.
I've never been in that area, so.
Yeah, so it's actually, yeah, it's pretty drivable during the summer. During the winter, you could, but it's about a 6-hour drive, which is pretty far. But for the winter, yeah, it's much longer than during the summer. Usually, if you're driving from, say, the northern end of the park, which is Gardner, which is where I live, driving all the way, say, to Jackson, which is the other side of the Tetons, it's about 4 hours. So, like, it's not horribly long. Nice. As far as like if you're already doing a pretty long trip, and even then the southern end of Yellowstone to the northern end of Tetons is only about like 15-20 miles, so it's not far between the parks.
Nice.
Yeah,
we did a camping trip with a friend of ours back in 2020 where we went to Rocky Mountain National Park, then Grand Teton, then Yellowstone. It was amazing. I didn't realize how close the two parks were, but it was awesome. We had an amazing time.
Yeah.
Patrick, do you have any other questions for Dylan or any comments?
So Yellowstone National Park, and again, like, correct me if I'm wrong, is basically, I don't want to say not built, but it's on top of like a volcano. Is that factually close?
Yep. No, actually, no, you are right. So Yellowstone lies on a super volcano. So actually the largest volcano in the U.S. So it actually lies on it. That's why we... Yeah, so that's actually why we have all of our hydrothermal features here in Yellowstone. Is Yellowstone actually has one of the highest concentrations of thermal features in the world. Like, it's where that's all due to it being on pretty much on top of an extremely large magma chamber, which leads to all of those features being able to, you know, get heat to where they're, you know, shooting off water and geysers, or where you have these extremely hot, like, you know, springs and pools. So that's actually all because it is on top of pretty much a volcano.
It's so, it's a little bit unnerving, like, if you sit there and like think about it. But going in as a guest, my first time in the park, we were doing something at Big Sky and made a day trip down there. And we pulled in and it was like pretty cool outside, and we drive in and there's just like steam, like, and this misty haze, like, and steam just kind of like jetting up all over the place. Absolutely gorgeous. But when you get closer to the pools and you see like all these gradients of all like these colors that like you don't see in like real life, like they're just so like vibrant, and it gets me really excited because I'm a dork. But it's just it's otherworldly. Like, it, you just don't see it, you know, I mean, outside of Yellowstone probably. But like, how do those colors get there?
Yeah, so those colors are actually mainly caused by thermophiles. So thermophiles being mostly heat resistant bacteria and archaea. So it's really cool where they pretty much live in these pools. So actually, like, this is Grand Prismatic right behind me on that poster. But that pool, like, all these like vibrant colors and everything is caused by those thermophiles. So pretty much where they cause those deep hues of like red and orange and blue, that's all caused by basically archaea and bacteria that live within those pools.
And like, are there different bacteria that cause like each color ring? So like, to those listening at home, behind Dylan in his office, he has this poster of this pool, and it's got this, I mean, rainbow ring around the edge of the pool, and that's all natural. Like, it happens in the real life. It's, you know, and so I guess, is it different bacteria that creates the different colors, or is it like, what is creating that magic?
So for that, it's mostly where it'd be based more of off of, excuse me, sorry, my voice is a little hoarse, but
oh, all good.
Yeah, I'm all good. But anyways, yeah, so it's where those different colors are all based off of pretty much different colorations and like the bacteria, but also from how much heat is being kind of put out by the pool. So it's a lot hotter here in the middle than it would be out further out.
Got it. Okay, cool. I that was one of the things, like the entire park is just gorgeous. But you know, like I said, I'm a dork. And so seeing like those colors and like the shiny, pretty, like, I don't know, it's really cool.
Yeah, no, it's
and super also
cool.
As an LGBT group, we have questions about the rainbow situation.
oh yeah, of course, all the colors. But yeah, that
I'm feeling that, very represented.
But yeah, that feature behind me is known as Grand Prismatic. So, you know, prismatic being all the colors of the rainbow and everything. So yeah, it makes sense.
Love it.
We have to go.
We have to.
Dylan, it's been an awesome time having you with us. Is there anything else that you would like to leave with the listeners as far as any insider tips or things that they should know or anything that you just want to share with them?
Yeah, I'd say just definitely, you know, enjoy the outdoors, do what you're happy with doing, and, you know, don't be afraid to recreate in any of the national parks here and enjoy the spaces for what they are. You know, Yellowstone is a specific example. Like, it's an amazing park with so much to do, and people in the LGBT community should definitely come out, see it for what it is, and enjoy it, and, you know, feel safe being who they are here. And I'm definitely looking forward to any of you guys or any of your listeners coming out here and being able to see the park. And if any of you are out here, definitely give me a holler. Like, I'm usually out every day in the field, so you could definitely look for me out there if you want to. And yeah, I'd love to interact with anyone that's, you know, part of your podcast or any of your listeners. So yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's amazing. How can people find you and learn more about you?
So yeah, for me, you could either reach out to me on Instagram. My Instagram is at hikingbird, all one word. And then you could also reach out on Facebook, which just Dylan Sanborn for that. And those would be kind of the two ways for reaching out to me.
That's amazing. Thank you so much awesome. For being with us. We really, really appreciate it. And it's a lot of great information for our listeners. So we're excited to be able to have you on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been great talking to all of y'all. And hopefully you learned a little bit more about Yellowstone and everything.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
Thanks so much. Bears.
Yeah, thank you.
And Bears. Before we off real quick as the group, JC, you mentioned about our local chapters, and you head up pretty much our local chapters and our ambassadors. Tell our listeners real quick what that is and how people could find out if there's a group in their area or how they could get involved.
So as many of you guys may or may not know, the ambassador program is the heartbeat of our organization. And we have chapters all over the country where you would find your local ambassadors, and they would be the ones to lead organized events, whether it's hikes, any sort of social activities that might be available in your group, in your state. The way to find that out is you go to our website, lgbtoutdoors.com, and there's a section for looking at where the local our local chapters are. All our ambassadors listed on there as well, and the area that they cover. If you're interested in joining the group, there is a Facebook group specifically for the state you're in, as long as there is an ambassador. And if you want to look up the event lineup that we have, you can also go on our website and register there.
And by group, you mean Facebook group?
Facebook group, yes.
Yes, perfect. All right. Well, thanks, guys. This was a great episode, and I hope that everyone listening got something out of it. We're excited to be launching this as a new aspect of LGBT Outdoors and help to bring more awareness and fulfilling our mission of connecting the LGBTQ community to the outdoors and to each other. So until next time, get out there. Conversation story you would like to share, please email it to us at info@lgbtoutdoors.com. Follow us on Instagram at lgbtoutdoors and join the community at facebook.com/groups/lgbtoutdoors. Become a partner by joining our Patreon, where you'll gain access to monthly bonus stories and exclusive content. For more information on today's episode, check out the show notes. For information about LGBT Outdoors, LGBT Outdoor Fest, local chapters, or to sign up for our newsletter, visit lgbtoutdoors.com. And if you're enjoying the show, please rate, review, and follow wherever you listen to podcasts.